Well, thanks everybody for joining. I want to say thanks everybody for tuning in. I like thinking Wi-Fi and picturing people turning knobs to kind of like, you know, tune in literally. So we're here with Comma Echo and to talk about Small Craft Warning. So I could go through everybody, but I don't want to mess anything up. So let's maybe just introduce yourselves one by one, if that's okay, and tell me like where you're coming from, where you're broadcasting from. So do you want to go with James?
Yeah, I guess I'll start. I am a photographer, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, whatever, artist really living in the Caribbean. Have been, you know, I was born in Trinidad. I grew up there. I went to school in England when I was like 12 in 1989. I met Lewis there, Lewis Sanchez. Became very friendly with him. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, he was like my introduction to like the formality of music. You know, I was always deeply into music, but this was the first time I'd ever seen anyone actually, you know, these are white keys and these are black keys and there's a science behind everything, and that opened a lot of doors for me. And then I ended up leaving England, going back to Trinidad, you know, to work there with a camera, getting these things. But between all of those experiences, I would be on the coast, you know, I would be and just surfing a lot, spending a lot of time in the ocean, and managed to bring all of that together in this. This is like a way for me to package a lot of experiences from my life, because this is coming from like more than 10 years of music and film and photography that all seemed to be heading in some direction, and I didn't really know what direction that was until more recently. And realized it was all about the ocean, it's all about the coast, and just that zone where so much energy detonates onto the land, you know. It's a really cool place to be and to write and to just draw inspiration from. So that's what Small Craft Warning, you know, is a product of that.
I'll probably make you say all of that again.
Sure. Well, I'll just splice it around.
Okay, well, I'm Lewis. I was born in Portugal, Portuguese parents, but when I was born, sort of my parents separated, one went to Switzerland and the other one stayed in Portugal. And when I was 11, I came to England because my mother remarried. By then, I discovered music because my grandmother was a pianist. So there was always a piano in her house, and I was just basically, I took a few lessons, but I mostly played, I taught myself. I played by ear. So hitting the keys enough times, you eventually figure it out.
A process of elimination.
Exactly. And eventually, you know, music it can be quite formulaic, so you can sort of figure out where things are. And then your fingers just sort of fall in the right place, you know, and you think of something, your fingers just do it, and it's great. So when I came to England when I was 11, you know, I started secondary education. I couldn't speak English. And, you know, fast forward a few years, I met James, and he had these crazy multicolored trousers. And he had a funny accent. So he was different, and I like different. So yeah, we became friends. Soon after we started making music together, you know, and created a band, and then another band, and another band, you know, and so on. You know, the music sort of just went on. But so you know, that was just the teenage years, music, bands, and everything. You know, then I went into sort of more formal music. I went into production, into audio engineering, setting up a recording studio with a friend, you know, doing all that stuff. But then I sort of fell into the trap of doing a regular job. I became a web developer, and because I thought that it would pay for all my gear, because, you know, musicians don't make much money. So I thought, well, if I get this job and I earn some money, I can buy the gear and then I can be a musician.
And you're coming to us from England now, right?
Yeah, from England, yeah, from Brighton.
Chaz, you're in England too?
Yeah, so I also grew up in Trinidad, and I also moved to England when I was 11. And I've been in love with guitar as an instrument. You know, I'm definitely a guitarist first and a musician second. And it's only been recently, in maybe the last 2 years, that I've started taking music itself seriously as opposed to just playing lots of guitar. So that's been, for the last couple of years, my journey. I'm in kind of a similar situation to Lewis, where I you know, definitely do a very full-time job in order to support doing music.
Okay, great. Sharda?
I'm in Trinidad right now. I'm a sitarist. It's an instrument that I started, well, I suppose, quite naturally, because my dad is. I first started with piano and then moved to sitar from about formally at the age of 9. My background is classical, North Indian classical music, but I do a lot of fusion, experimental work, a lot of stuff with artists, poets, writers, that sort of thing. My main job is writing and research. I've now shifted more to fiction writing and pretty much full time.
Fantastic. And as I say, last but not least, don't feel left out there, Kiwan.
Yeah, so my name is Kiwan Landreth Smith, born and raised in Trinidad. I was actually en route a career in natural gas in the oil and gas industry. I started playing guitar when I was 16 or 17, which is late. And I was the worst guitarist out of my whole crew that started. So I was just trying to play catch up all the time.
Was it a get the girls thing?
Nah, you know what? It wasn't about that at all, actually. It was about release. I used to listen to a lot of gangster rap and dub and dancehall growing up. And then I discovered Nirvana. And that had a kind of sweet aggression to it, a kind of utopic thing about it. It was this huge expression of rage that I fell in love with. And it made sense to me. So I wanted to become part of that. So what I did was I picked up the guitar. I started feeling that energy. And yeah, so by the time I was 24, I was managing an onshore natural gas processing facility for British Gas. And then I went offshore and I worked with BP on a platform called Mahogany B. And then I just quit. And I've been doing music full time since then, because I just had songs going through my head all the time, you know? But parallel to music, I'm actually I know James through surfing, then through video, and lastly through music, which is actually where we connected the most. Yeah. You know, so we met at a musical junction, and it was really fun. This project, Comma Echo.
You want to kind of throw it back to James now and sort of talk about the genesis?
The thing with the ocean, and it's interesting talking about being out on a platform, because this is the reality of where I've been. You spend a lot of time by yourself, and you spend a lot of time, you know, literally just watching the sea sometimes. You might spend a lot of time on the way to a shoot that's remote, there's no road to it or whatever, and you're going up the coast on a little pirogue, which is a little wooden boat, and there's like a 25 horsepower Yamaha outboard engine. It's going, and you get the rhythm of the hull of the boat, you know, hitting wave after wave. It's always brought a hook to my head, and I've always, paid attention to that as opposed to just saying, whatever, man, I'm busy.
You're in Trinidad, you're writing songs in your head and filming, and you've got that film career. And so what is the step to do anything with that? Why decide to make the project and then talk about roping in, these guys?
That's a really interesting question. Why not just hum it in your head and just leave it right there, right? Working in film for a long time, 15 years, I have had the responsibility of taking, most of the time it's been my client's work and finishing it. Yeah. So it's been very much the case of, you got to go out, you got to do an interview, you got to get some sound, you got to tell a story, you need to get some supporting visuals, you need to build this thing up for a reason. And so my training and just my whole energy has always been towards finish it the best that you possibly can. And I must confess that at some point, very early on, I thought, I'll do this mostly by myself and maybe Lewis will help me. But I just have always had the pleasure, as I said in film, of working with different people to do all of those disciplines that I was telling you about. So I would have something in my head that I kind of knew would be the finished product. but it's got these other six or seven disciplines and you need these best people. And it's one of the best things in the world to work with, like, the best drone operator or the best Steadicam operator, you know, or, you know, a guy who specializes in underwater film and photography, which would be my, you know, that's what I bring to a project, for example. So, and then when you put all those things together, you have, like, something that competes with primetime, something that if it comes on my TV at, you know, when I should be watching something else, I'm not turning it off because it sounds great and it looks great and people put a lot of work into it.
But all right, so you were in touch with Lewis over all this time? In between, you guys talked music, you guys...
This whole project wouldn't have happened if James hadn't been texting me hundreds of messages over 15 years. And, you know, and I would ignore them because I was just, this IT job that I took is basically, it was just insanely, it's just too much work. And I've got a family, you've got kids. So it's just, you know, life is really hectic. I love music, but I just had no time for it. You know, and then, you know, here's my friend who's gone back to Trinidad and he's just saying, hey, let's just do this song. Let's just do that song. So, okay. And I try and stay up till 2 a.m. and do a little bit. Three of the tracks, I think, were ready in 2006 when you were going to go and do it by yourself, I think. Exactly. Yeah, so
yeah.
The process of the album itself, it wasn't something that you guys decided recently, you know, we need to really do this. This is actually something you guys have been working on over a period of years.
Yeah. So, the original, some tracks are very old. Some ideas are old, others sort of evolved throughout, some of our collaboration together. And then they sort of organically took form and became better tracks, or more interesting tracks. And if it wasn't for James having the relentless energy to keep pushing and putting everything together and packaging and arranging it all, none of this would have happened.
So what would happen to me is I would get up one morning, check my email, and there's a piano track from Lewis. And it would be like Easter and Christmas and, you know, all of these things rolled in together because it meant that it's like a huge pin that I'd put in something and said, I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to work on something else because this track here, all I need is the piano track from Lewis now. And he would just deliver one day and I'd be like, it's done, you know, and then 3 years later, it'd be more done. But that's how it went.
Sort of a cumulative effect between the messages and the work itself. Would you guys rope in afterwards? Who was the first of the other three?
Oh, Kiwan, for sure.
Yeah, so I got the demo and I was really pleasantly surprised about the quality of the songs and how I felt about them. So, like, I connected to the content of the songs. You know, my first impression was like, all right, cool. I'm thinking of James more, like, I know he's a video guy, I know he's a surfer. And he didn't sound 100% confident in the work. He was kind of, he had some intrepidation about approaching.
I've never heard James with trepidation. What does that sound like?
It sounds like him pitching the project to me, right? I listened to it and it was like, all right. And he actually used some chords that are not like run-of-the-mill simple chords. It's whatever James was feeling at the time. And so it was a challenge to, it was a challenge to deconstruct it and to find the harmonic content for me, as a like how I would guide myself to create, but it was fun. I know the original and the finished project, and it's like two renditions of the same songs, and I like both of them equally, actually.
So how did you back and forth that? Because you didn't really sit in a studio together and perform it, did you? Or did you do that?
I don't think I ever sat down and played guitar while James was there. Like, James and I, we would probably listen to a couple of things and we'd talk more. But the actual, you know, my performances that I recorded, those were done in solitude. So I would sit down and I would really get into the track. And yeah, so that's pretty much the workflow.
The sitar has always been, for me, associated with stories. It just adds that texture. It was super important. So when we talked about the lead guitar, like why we talked so much was because we were trying to like how do we do this so that we are having a conversation between the lyrics, the lead guitar, and what the sitar is, you know, doing in between there as well. We didn't want to just all play over each other. We wanted to really allow each other the different room to express what it was we were doing.
Yeah, because I had played music with Sharada before. Naturally, I was like, yeah, well, I know this person and she plays sitar beautifully and she had nice compositions. So, and you know, at a certain point in your musicianship, like your personality comes through on the instrument. So her spirit was one that I thought would fit nicely in the realm of things of this project, you know.
I'm always game for a new project, for an interesting project. Collaborations I particularly like doing. This project was actually the first project I felt where the person doing, you know, it's yours, James, right? And you had a clear idea as to what you wanted. Usually the sitar comes in more like an exotic sound, more than a musical instrument. So I really enjoyed working on this. As K1 was saying, I felt that I connected with the music as well. If you can feel me. Yeah, definitely was a big role for the sitar, and it was easier to work on this. Even though I spent, I think two of the tracks were a little bit problematic for me in terms of the, you know, what he wanted. But it was easy in that he knew what he wanted. Dave, what Indian classical music does is gives you a lot of modes to work with, similar to jazz, but there are all these hundreds of different combinations of things that create modes.
And it's microtonal as well, right? So you can't just transpose those scales.
Right, but in my own music, I break the rules. And I combine modes and so on. And yeah, I sort of play with it because I like experimenting. So if I were to produce a piece, like Ewan was saying, James came with very strange chord combinations, I'd probably be one of those. because I'll be working primarily through mood music.
Yeah.
And Chaz, how do you come into this?
So I'm pretty late to the project. Basically, I got a Facebook message from James asking if I would retrack pretty much all of the acoustic guitars on the album. I managed to fortunately talk him down from doing as many as he thought. Because the longer you spend on a project, the less you want to put it out there. And so to see a project like this that's been going on for years and years actually see the light of day is really interesting.
There are social messages and that sort of thing within the music, in the stories.
Yeah, the metaphor of the storm is definitely there for a reason. You know, it starts in the rain. That's very true to, you know, rainy season in Trinidad, just hurricane season approaching. And, you know, you can feel just being there, sitting on the coast. And then lyrically, the song, you know, deals with the violence of the country and the crime situation. Because, you know, there's crime, but there's violent crime. And, you know, that was something that was affecting me in Trinidad when I was getting to the point where we were making decision to leave, you know, because we had small kids, and just a bunch of other reasons.
Come quick. There's a body in the river, rust beneath a mirror. They don't think it's been there for...
I wrote that song really to kind of, like, express my sort of my anger or my feeling towards the leadership at the time.
Can't see. Now the crowd is getting thicker. They jostle and they bicker.
The road to nowhere literally is describing the socioeconomic policy, or the national security policy, I should say, of not just Trinidad and Tobago, but that region, Latin American region. The war on drugs, you know, the way that they've fought it, certainly being the same way over and over and over and over and over and over again. And this is something that I wanted to get through in the music. So also, like, I don't know, Kiwan, if you remember this, but I sent you that track and I was like, look, this guitar solo, I just want you to play this one note. I want you to play this one note for the whole solo. And I think in the end he was like, nah, I'm gonna play three. And I was like, you know, whatever, you're the musician. But for me, it was really to drive home that it was like, it was gonna go on and on and on. This is the road. That's kind of where the project, I said, I'm gonna do this project, I'm gonna do that song. It was a huge song for me to get over in terms of my mental state. It's not necessarily a negative energy, I think, to shine a light on a negative situation.
You, with a black suit tie and a gleam in your eye, cause you sit so high, so high. No matter how many times we occupy, you exemplify the means to the end of this game. You have no shame, you take no blame, and it's all the same. If every man, woman, child in the world has a fight, just to ease the pain. Peace, peace. It's not a four-letter word.
Let's talk about Don Juan.
All right.
You got there.
I'm a writer. Don't try this at home, folks. I'm a writer. I'm a professional.
Don't fall there, Hugh.
What's interesting about that song is it was written long before I had any idea of doing an album. Or, you know, releasing any music. We were working with a friend of mine, Chris Dennis. You've got to go online and look at wavesforhope.org. Chris is doing an amazing program with kids up in Ballandra up there in Trinidad, getting kids into surf therapy. These are at-risk kids who, you know, they live in an area and in a sort of a depressed economic situation where they don't have many opportunities to express themselves, learn life skills, learn to communicate and get along, which is a real big hurdle. And so he's really taking that on as his project to impact that area and those kids' lives. But prior to that, how we met Chris was he wanted to go on tour. He wanted to surf against the you know, the top 100 surfers in the world. And he, you know, I met him up in Toku. He told me that was his plan, and I thought, that is the most audacious idea I've ever heard. That's kind of how my attitude towards life in general is, to set my goals too high. And I thought that he had set his goal too high. And so I encouraged him. I said, oh, that sounds like a lofty idea. I'll make a documentary about your efforts. And I mean, Chris is, you know, he's a great surfer. He's as good as anybody that I've seen on tour surf at the time. And so I endorsed him 100%. I said, look, I'll get my team on this. We're going to make you a documentary. And we spent pretty much a year filming this movie to help him get on tour. So we got sponsors into the film, and the money went on his plane tickets and the insurance that he needed and the entry fees and stuff. And he did it. We were doing something that I felt was not likely to succeed, or at least where you would call success on it, you know, based on the outcomes, was something that was very subjective. Yeah, it was just a way to manage expectations, and it turned out to be a really beautiful song. And to get it in the film, again, this was something I sent Lewis the visuals. I said, look, this is what it looks like, bro. You know, and this is how I feel about it.
Feels like no one's watching you until you fall. It's just how it feels. It's just how it feels.
If you want to just bring that home for me, because wrap it up in terms of what you ended up doing afterwards with that more recently.
So the main thing is, everybody needs to know, if you stream that song, or you watch the music video, or you engage with that piece of content anywhere, and it's monetized, we give that money from Digital Streams to Waves for Hope. So that's money that actually goes towards surfboards and equipment for kids to basically go do the surf therapy program. And they do an awesome job, and we're really, really stoked to be part of that. And if you do play that song and repeat it 100 million times, because that actually makes a difference.
A nice thing about this whole project is that it's heavily conceptualized, and there's a lot of thought and a lot of content behind the music. And luckily, James expresses in songwriting, but he's also he expresses visually as well. Like he's a visual artist. So the video for Don't Fall really added a next dimension to the song, to the piece of work. So, and it's not separate from the song. It's one, to me, it's one presentation, you know? You know, I'm encouraging that 100%, because everything, it just gets more dimension, and it just, you can just see it from different perspectives. And so I'm looking forward to, like, to you, you know, putting out more video content to everything, to all of it. To me, it's one and the same. It's all expression. It's all, you know, you're creating a world, you know, whatever the world is in your mind or in your heart, and to bring it out there and shape it for other people to observe. To me, that is, you know, that is the stuff. That's what art is about, and the craft of it is the skill in putting together that presentation.
You know, my mind changes every day. I'm like, no, today I like this one. But yeah, I give you mine just because of the sentiment and what it is, that sort of humanitarian angle. Especially what's going on now, you know, people are really scrambling to find a way to express how they feel about first responders and that kind of thing. And I think Give You Mine is a really good example of that kind of sentiment.
James put together this video. I looked at it and I had sort of a pocket of time, which is very rare. So I was sort of responding to these different sections, visual sections. For me, it was just a stream of music, just sort of emotion. I was responding to the images. It's, you know, inspiration comes from anywhere and anything, and it, you've got to be in the right mindset. So even the wrong mindset might make you sort of create something. But you know, you just need a bit of time. And if you sit down with your instruments, you know. I mean, for me, it's impossible not to write something.
So when you did this music to the film footage, was it the intent at that point in time to create a song? Or is it that, no, that wasn't the end intent?
For me, it wasn't. I wasn't aware of it. I think that basically, because my musical output is so rare, because I'm always so busy, you know, James had the vision to always grab anything that I created and say, well, hang on, that bit there, you could use that, you know, since you're too busy to write any other stuff. Yeah. Let's just grab that and make something with it, you know, and he has, you know, and it's brilliant. Never break your heart. Yeah. Tell me what you're looking for and I'll give you mine. Give you mine. It's gonna stop us now. Together we fly away.
I would say it's just that anyone who has experienced the north coast of Trinidad and Tobago can attest that the music in this album is what that feels like. It's one of the most incredible places I've ever been, and I'm really glad to see that this music is actually kind of doing it justice. It really does tell that story. Strong arms taken quickly down. The water swirling all around. If you've ever been in that sea, you know it's like, it is a genuinely scary place. And I've been, you know, kind of free diving and spear fishing out there. And you are at mercy to the water. Strange to see
signs of his home. There's a lot of stories from up there, and it's a very, very dangerous place, treacherous place to live. And you can, you know, slip and fall, and you know, in 5 seconds you're 100 yards out in the sea, and it's not going to give up. And the one behind that term, it is the knowledge that after this one, there's another one. It's totally a metaphor for life, and I hope that people get that. Certainly is for me anyway, you know, that sort of endless hold down. You know, and the water's fizzing around you because it's just exhaling. All of the bubbles are coming up at once, right?
Especially on big days when it's like triple overhead, bigger than that. I like the one behind, Stingray 2 to me. It's so musical. I mean, the Stingray is just a piece of music, really. But the one behind, I love the imagery and I love everything about that song, really.
That was actually one of my favorite tracks, apart from Road to Nowhere, which I liked. I like the energy of Road to Nowhere. Stingray felt like there was a whole dance going on with the instruments, and I was listening back to it and it's very emotional.
Was the back and forth, just to try and clarify, the back and forth with you and Lewis, as you described before, with the visuals going to him and creating music.
Yeah.
How's that balance struck? I mean, you guys co-writers?
So, as you know, because we work a lot together, Hugh and I, Hugh is a writer with The Art of Storytelling, which is the company that we run, my wife and I. We literally pass a actual Premiere Pro project between us. And that's what Lewis and I have done, is that we've shared Logic Pro X files. We were meant to be.
Because, you know, I grew up in Portugal. I could only speak Portuguese and French only, but I couldn't speak English. So most popular music was in English. So, and for me, it was just, you know, it was just an instrument. The English voice was an instrument. And even though I speak English now reasonably well, I still don't pay attention to words. I don't listen to words in songs mostly. For me, it's an instrument. So it's all about music and how harmonies and how things work together. So quite often I'm surprised by the lyrical content of stuff that I've known forever. There's even songs that, you know, I knew as a kid, that if I sing them back, you know, it just feels right, you know, whatever instrument it is.
Like a Yamaha 25 horsepower outboard engine. It's just an instrument. See?
What I was going to get to, because part of my curiosity, you know, you, James, you obviously pull from, you've mentioned different experiences in life. Look, you're looking at kind of almost tackling certain issues through these things, or issues that you've tackled, whether it be life and death or the you know, dealing with the loss of a loved one or social issues. So I was just curious, and it's you know, it's perfectly fine if it's not the same, but like with Lewis, when you're tackling your side of things, do you draw on anything in particular, you think, or...
It's just pure emotion. Just, you know, for me, music just has this strong emotion. So it just, as I write it, it just drives itself, you know, and I just sort of go where it goes. Yeah, and that's what I like about not being given a brief, and you just have full creativity. You do what you feel is right. And as long as you've got the right gear and the right time and the right skills to get it across, then you can just do anything you want, which is brilliant.
As an artist, you have to respect that what you are looking for in the music, or what you've decided is your inspiration for the music, isn't necessarily important to the listener. I think music is so subjective that it's important to respect that if someone hears a song and thinks, that's what this means to me, then that's what that means. We connect an emotion from music to something that was happening to us at the time. There's so many songs from, you know, from when I was growing up that definitely don't mean how I feel about them. But you hear something in a situation and then you listen to it again and you feel that feeling again. It's something incredible that it can trigger that memory and that emotion. But once you put it out there, it's not really yours anymore. The message doesn't belong to you or to anyone. It belongs to the listener. Maybe it's all just energy.
I feel you in the wind.
James, describe, you know, as well as you can, the intention behind the song, and I'm like, okay. And then I go and I interpret it a certain way. And then we go back and forth having this philosophical conversation about, you know, emotions and...
Because you had different solos, right? We had different solos for the one behind. And for me, because I was like, what was your interpretation of a hold down? What was your interpretation of a four-way of hold down?
The way I interpreted it and what I played two versions. One was a salvation after getting held down and you're like, and then you go back out and you end up riding, you know, you get your reward for the punishment. I think we went with the reward, but the other flip side to it was actually experiencing, you know, your survival mechanisms come into play where mm-hmm. you're trying not to panic. You're trying to stay calm, you're in the belly of the beast and you're just like, you know, there's an intense sense of danger around you, but you're comfortable in it.
It's interesting what Chaz was saying there, because you're talking about working on an instrumental and you're saying you can't do something because it's underwater. What does that even mean?
I don't know if you guys ever heard this mix. I know Kiwan heard it early on. There was actually a GoPro solo in that song. And it was just one of those sounds when, you know, you hear the camera rolling around, you hear the swirling of the water and all of this stuff. And I had it in there as literally a GoPro solo. and I didn't keep it because I felt like it was just like, this is just really far out.
You should have kept it like real, real low.
I know. Maybe it's still there, you know?
So just run through quickly for me where this album was recorded, as in, like, technically this album has already traveled.
So the Logic file has moved around, like, you know, digitally, like the same files in Kiwan Studio in Trinidad, my home here in Orangeville in Ontario, and in Lewis's studio in England. That's how the stuff has moved around digitally. And I was thinking recently that, you know, we're now in this lockdown situation, pandemic, and I read every day about how artists are having to figure this out. And we've been doing this for a long time, you know, and in my work, the way we work, the way Hugh and I work now, you know, we're not ever in the same place. And I just wanted to put that out there as to say, don't think that this is that hard even, you know what I mean?
Well, it only took you guys since 2008, so I mean, really?
Oh, come on.
2006. I sit corrected.
And that was the demo, so...
Gravity is probably the oldest song. I think Gravity and actually Small Craft Warning. Small Craft Warning has got some guitar runs in it that I've held on to for a long time. But Gravity as a song I wrote, you know, when I was still having girlfriends, I don't know, 20 years old or something. And I wrote it because I felt like, hey, if you want to be a rock star, man, you got to have a breakup tune. So I wrote it and, you know, I've been writing it for the last however many years. From girlfriend time, that's probably like 103 years ago or something. And so the song has kind of had a different meaning to me.
Yeah. I was the one who let you down. I can't believe I'll be so dumb.
So the title track of the album, Small Craft Warning, is a song that it really has three parts to it. There's the quiet boat launch, and the sky is beautiful, and you know the sea is calm, and it's so saturated, the blues and greens, it's just a beautiful coastal day. And then we get into a really fierce storm. Such a struggle in the music at that point, and then all of a sudden piano lifts you.
Yeah, the transitions in that song is cool. It's like it's really avant-garde and
the some of the best composition from Lewis on that album, where it kind of opens up as a really brilliant piece, and it really does feel like you're watching a film.
That's the thing with a hold down, man. You know, when you get held down, kind of don't know when it's going to end. And when it does, it feels exactly like that song.
We've been talking to Comma Echo. Their single Don't Fall is available now to stream everywhere, and all proceeds go to help wavesforhope.org. Comma Echo's album Small Craft Warning is available June 1st.
Stay.